Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 106, being recorded on the 10th of December, 2015. My name is Sujit Mello, and on Skype, I have my esteemed colleagues, Kale Teeter and Evan Basilik. Hey, Evan, glad you could join us. We decided to get started in the interest of time.
Yeah, sorry about that, guys.
No problem. Just in time. I was just making the initial announcement, and they popped up.
I was waiting for it's like fashionably late.
Right? I know, that's right. Well, today is going to be, Kale had, we were kind of wondering what kind of topic we could talk about today, and you know, we seem to have covered a lot recently, and Kale had this good idea about covering this, I guess the way he puts it is many clouds, different frameworks, right? How do different apps and on different cloud platforms or internal platforms migrate to Azure? What do they have to go through? And we're going to talk about some of the intricacies with various patterns that you could use to move to Azure and some of the problems that you might face. But before we get there, as usual, let's get our listeners caught up with some new updates in the Azure space. Kale, I noticed you put some items in there. Anything particular you want to pick on?
Yeah, probably the first one that's close to my heart is DocumentDB. So with the recent SDK, you know, 2.81, I think we announced last time, that thing's out there now. And as a part of that is some deeper integration with DocumentDB. So recently we released, and it was with 2015, at some point we'd released Cloud Explorer, which is kind of like this little toolbox thing that slides out from the side in Visual Studio for you to kind of manage resources up there, kind of like we did with Server Explorer. And when Cloud Explorer came, it had support for ARM, right? So we had all the ARM-enabled things coming up there, all our different resources. And now DocumentDB is in there, but the integration is pretty awesome. So it's not only can you go up and see your DocumentDB accounts and your databases and collections, but you can actually drill through into the actual documents and actually edit them inside Visual Studio with the JSON editor and that stuff. So it's really interesting that we have that kind of deep kind of
nice
integration.
It sounds like a SQL-like tool, but for DocumentDB kind of thing.
Yeah. I think it'll help enable, you know, at least people that are getting started. You know, once you have things kind of going, it's good. But when you're designing schemas or you're kind of toying around with it when you're first getting started, I think it'll enable that.
I agree. That is brilliant. And another one of the things that you put in there, which I found very fascinating, it's this the Azure Data Lake tools for Visual Studio. Well, what's fascinating about this is that I heard about this term called USQL. I mean, we've all heard of TSQL, right? The Transact SQL is what we're used to. But there's this new, new type of language called USQL or USQL scripts that are used to do massively parallel queries and data processing with the Azure Data Lake system. And so this new set of tools for Visual Studio lets you, you know, edit the USQL, allows you to debug it and things like that right from within Visual Studio. So, you know, hey, it's something new. You learn something new every day here.
Well, I mean, this is just, you know, Visual Studio has, it's amazing how many things you can do design time things in with it now. I mean, everything.
Almost all the cloud things are slowly out there, yeah.
I call it gravity. Things just get pulled towards it.
It's just getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, I mean, obviously as a developer, I mean, all of us are developers. So we feel like Visual Studio is the center of the universe, right? Everything kind of revolves around that. And, well, that's what we thought in the past, but it's slowly getting there where all sorts of things you can do from Visual Studio now. And it soon will be the center of the universe. It's becoming its own little operating system almost. It's strange to say that, but that's how I
Yeah.
feel.
Well, I mean, you don't even need Visual Studio to use Visual Studio anymore, right? There's the Visual Studio, is it called Code, I think?
Code, yeah.
Yeah,
Code,
I
yeah.
mean.
Well, yes, and code doesn't have the plugins and everything that Visual Studio has. But there's Visual Studio Community Edition, right, which is our free version of Visual Studio.
Yep.
So it's not like you have to, pay for the professional something if you don't need all those features. You can still get a lot just with the free Community Edition.
Cool.
So.
Yeah, and one other thing to mention here that's kind of new is this I haven't experienced yet. I'm really interested in this because I could see how this could grow to other areas of Azure. But in the app service, things that we deploy up there, web apps, all the different app services that we can deploy, we now have this stuff built into the portal called recommendations. So it's kind of a little bit, it reminds me a little bit of this. Security Center features that we released at Azure Security Center, where it can actually proactively look at behavior or things that are happening up there, and based on that, make recommendations to say, "Hey, you should do this," or "You left a door open." With App Service, it goes a little bit deeper. Like you could say, "Hey, you're getting close to your quota," or all these different pieces about deployment slots or things that would be relevant or in context sensitive to your app service that you're running up there. It can actually start to make recommendations. So if it sees you're starting to deviate into a known area where you might experience trouble or you're starting to get close to a limit or something,
Right.
it can actually start to do that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it reminds me of the best practices analyzers that we had years past, which I guess may still exist. I haven't seen one in a while, but where except the difference with those was you had to, get it, download it, run it against yours, and then, look at the report. In this case, it's kind of real time. We're always looking at your service.
Yep.
Cool. Well, there's another one interesting, not really a news service in Azure, but interesting blog item that Kale found and put out there. This is, I guess, the age-old question, right? We've got all these SQL servers that we have developed over the years. Each, you might have different versions all the way from SQL 2000 to 2014 or whatever the latest and greatest is. And you have to, you want to move, you want to kind of consolidate them, and you want to upgrade them. But and you also want to try and put them into the cloud, maybe, right? Using SQL Azure, and it's a daunting task because you have all these different versions. You don't know the compatibility, what works, what won't work. And so there's this nice blog item that one of the PMs from the engineering services team within Microsoft, well, they're facing the same problem. They've got all these SQL servers that they use to service the internal apps or some of the external apps that Microsoft has, and they wanted to do the same thing. They wanted to consolidate it into one or two versions of SQL, and so she talks about, Audrey talks about some of the process that they went through to kind of consolidate and migrate all these disparate old versions of SQL Server that they had into just, a small set of them. And of course, running in Azure. I mean, and in her case, they decided to use the VMs running SQL. But, the process they went through was very good.
Yeah, did you get the thing that I thought was really twofold interesting about this one was the first is that this is just proof that we at Microsoft are not immune to any of the problems that anybody else has, right? You have this production app and
Yep.
you're worried about upgrading it and the like. The other thing was, and this was just kind of thrown in there, didn't really call it out, but this Stretch database.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. That's what caught my eye when I first saw this. Yeah.
I went and looked at that and said, "Man, that's really cool."
That's
It's
cool.
like store simple for your database.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have some of your data hot, basically on premises in your SQL Server instance, or I guess it could be an Azure VM, and then the rest of your data cold in SQL Azure. I mean, I thought that was really kind of neat. I have to. I may have to. I think we should probably track somebody down who can talk to us about this, because I'm not entirely sure that I get all the aspects of it. But it sounds like a really neat way to take advantage of the best of both, right?
Yeah, I could see a lot of good use case for this, and The other thing to call out is the lady's title. We definitely have to have her on the podcast. She's part of the data group SEALs. That's awesome. Like, I didn't even know that existed. Like,
yeah.
Awesome.
Yep.
And the last one is back to the open source side of the world with the new certification for Linux on Azure. So we actually have a certification exam. Now, it looks like it goes out to an external provider, but it's part of our tracks now, that we actually have a track for Linux on Azure to become certified in that. So that's interesting, and it's just out there. But there's one provider, if you go out, we'll put a link out there to it. Basically goes through, it's called the LFCS exam, which is the Linux Foundation Certified System Administrator exam. And then you have to have the 533 for Azure infrastructure, basically.
Right.
So, interesting thing for...
That's a sign that, you know, I think Microsoft has matured in the cloud space, where Microsoft is offering Linux certification on Azure.
That's one of those that just kind of blows your mind, right? Because we talk about it, but I mean, that's really putting our money where our mouth is, right? In the sense that there's this cert. So we invested in a cert for it. So I don't know. Does that count if you walk into a Linux shop and say, I have a Microsoft certification for Linux? What did they say? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely a skill that's going to become, you know, more important. It's not just Azure. It's also Amazon and all the others. I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing to run these things. It's one thing to run Windows Server, and it's one thing to run, you know, Red Hat on-prem. And then it's another one to run it in Azure, like the way the storage system works and what are the peculiarities about, you know, Amazon and things.
Yeah.
You know, that's an interesting question. I just thought about that just now. If you're running something in a VM, right, and you want to run in the cloud, how much difference is it, you know, if you're running a VM in Azure versus, say, Amazon or, say, Google? Does Google offer VMs? I don't remember now. How different is it? Like, how many different variables are there for somebody who is trying to do a lift and shift of an app in a VM? That they have to think about, oh, you know, in Azure, I got to do these, you know, 25 things, but on AWS, I got to do those 25 things.
I mean, I think it's really different parts, right? I mean, if you look at it, a guest VM is a guest VM is a guest VM.
Right.
Right. But I think where you definitely see differences in the services is how they've implemented various things, or, you know, this feature or that. This feature's in AWS, that feature's in Azure. You know, so I really do think the Azure cloud has matured to the point that it's not an either or anymore. I think there are some workloads that probably, you know, as much as it sort of pains me to admit it, probably are more suited to the feature set that you can see in Amazon. And there are some workloads that are more suited to the feature set, you know, with Azure. I mean, ExpressRoute is a different solution than Direct Connect.
Correct. But, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, Evan, I was more referring to the all the various infrastructure items, like, for example, networking or the deployment aspect, right? We have things like DSC and allows you to run Chef and Puppet and whatnot. So from that perspective, right, if I were to have a VM, a custom app in a VM, and I want to put it up in the cloud, you know, I mean, I do believe that, you know, the Azure VM is a little more advanced and has much more features. But I just wonder, like, you know, how much, what do you really need that much specialty to run a VM in the cloud, like, from an application perspective?
I think it depends on your workload, right? I mean, if you're doing just, hey, I've got a web server and a SQL server.
Right.
You're probably not going to notice the difference, right? There is no difference.
Yeah, but if you're running SAP or some other thing, something special like that.
I mean, it kind of goes to our topic, you know, tonight about, you know, these different clouds and all that thing. But I agree with Evan. It depends, right? Like, if you're running simple workloads, from my experience, it's pretty easy, right, relatively, mm-hmm. to move between, right? So if we're running on one cloud, want to move to another one, mm-hmm. It's running on a VM. It's not tightly integrated into a platform service or something. then it's easy, right? But I don't think so. It's easy for large scale applications or large scale enterprises, these kind of things where they're kind of pushing the edge, you know, of how much I/O they need or how much, you know, CPUs they need. We have monster GMs or VMs. And so does Amazon, and so do all these providers. But the thing is, they're all slightly different. That's where that piece starts to come down, I think, at least my experience. The big ones for me are around storage, because the storage systems vary quite a bit. Some of the more advanced features, like you said, Sajid, I agree with that too, the virtual networks and those kind of things. They all do the same thing, right? So they all provide some sort of connectivity, but they do it in slightly different ways, and they each have, you know, kind of pros and cons, right? So it's figuring out what those are.
Right. Okay, so I'm glad you brought that up, then. So let's kind of dive into the main topic, right, that we're going to talk about today, which is about migrating between these clouds. You had some points, I guess, talking points listed out. What's this thing about the one interface to rule them all? You kind of put a link out to libcloud.apache.org. Give us some background on that.
Yeah, so that's a framework that's kind of emerging out there now that's getting some steam behind it. There's a couple other ones out there, but this one's the open source one from Apache. And really what that's about is creating that little middle layer there to, let's for instance talk about storage, blob storage. So if you're running something like OpenStack on-prem, you would be using Swift. So Swift is just like our blob storage in Azure, and it's very similar to S3 storage in Amazon. So how do you, move between those? The first thing is, what do I do? What if I wanted to write a modern application now, but I don't want to, you know, quote unquote, lock into a cloud vendor's storage solution? Because each one of these, they all have REST APIs in front of them. But the REST APIs are different, obviously. So how do you write to them? They each have different sizes around, you know, when you're uploading bits of data, how big could those be? How big can the greater whole, like one single file, how big can that be? So breaking all that kind of stuff down. But libcloud is kind of a model or a framework that's trying to kind of break that down so we could say, hey, what if we could write to an interface and then have similar to the way ARM does, right, where we have these providers that can then plug into it,
right.
And then you could say, hey, my app's writing to this data store, doesn't know what's on the other side of it, and then in configuration, I can pass in, it's Amazon, it's Microsoft, or it's OpenStack, you know, all these different things.
That's very ambitious, definitely. So this thing initially covers just the storage part, is that what they're aiming to?
No, actually, they have a complete provider model up there, DNS, some of the networking features. It's expanding. I don't know if storage was the first one, but it's definitely one that's kind of matured up there.
Yeah, I was looking through this the other day, and the one thing that this struck me as, it's not necessarily a bad thing, it just is that this struck me a lot like T-SQL, which, you know, again, because I was a SQL Server, you know, support engineer for a long, long time, and you know, you get some classes of applications that come through and say, hey, we're going to optimize for Oracle or MySQL or SQL Server, and then you get this other batch that come through and say, no, we're going to be agnostic, mm-hmm. you know, because we want to be able to run against SQL or Oracle or MySQL. With the folks that are agnostic, they truly can run against anything, and you know, it's really mix and match, plug and play from the customers, the end user or customer's perspective. But the downside then is they typically don't get to take advantage of the features
yep.
that differentiate each of those platforms. I looking through this, it struck me as the same as, hey, you know, if you're, and it goes back to Sajid, I think your question and comments earlier around, you know, if I'm doing, you know, this fairly well-defined workload and I'm not really pushing the boundaries and not really pushing what the platform one does, this seems like something that would be a great way to do it, because then I can, you know, do it in, you know, cloud provider A and cloud provider B and decide, you know, I can use either one. I don't have to change what I'm doing. But then if there's some specific feature or functionality you need, well, now you're locked in because of that feature, not necessarily because of your API.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's, you're making it easy for yourself to move from one to another, but in reality, I don't know if anybody's actually going to move, right? Once you start getting used to one particular cloud provider, or it, you're never going to move. I mean, I know my like a lot of our customers, they build these very fancy database kind of abstraction layers, right? Because they don't want to get locked into a database. Well, it's 15 years later and they're still using SQL Server, you know, and they have never moved off of it. So now they all that effort went in to build that abstraction layer, but they're still using SQL Server, you know. So it's something like that, you know. But
I see two different use cases for something like this. I see it like that, which I don't know if I would 100% buy into that. I could see it because I hear a lot of times, from larger companies saying we don't want to lock into a cloud, and especially comes around the platform services, right? So if there's like something really specific to a cloud provider, they'll say I'm not into that because I can't do that anywhere else. And if that thing, God forbid, isn't supported in the future or something, and I build a bunch of stuff around it, I don't like it. That's a thing, right? But I don't know. I think I see a lot more of people optimizing because they're trying to take advantage of what they have up there. So they want to make sure they can squeeze as much as they can out of that thing that they're getting up there. But of course, then you do have a little bit. But I think a lock-in. The thing I think about the libcloud though, you can actually use it for migrations, I think too. So you could say, hey, I need to move this stuff between, cloud vendor A and cloud vendor B. This thing can talk to both. So we could build tool sets around that kind of thing to help these tool sets that do that kind of stuff. So I can read from this one, and then I know how to write to this one, and then I can start optimizing for what I do over there.
No, I think that's one. I think the other one too is the ISVs, and I take it back. I think these ISVs still exist, but now that I say it, I'm not sure. Like, so if you look at the on-premises world, there's this class of ISVs that sell software, but the customer installs it in their environment. I could see folks like that adopting this, right? Because then it's up to the end customer whether they deploy it on Cloud Vendor A or Cloud Vendor B. But it just occurred to me that in a world where that software gets deployed to a cloud anyway, maybe they don't give the end user the option. Maybe they just turn it into a PaaS service in essence.
Exactly, yeah. And I was going to come to that. Like, I think one of the downsides of taking this very abstracted view of the cloud is you can't take advantage of all the PaaS services, right? We don't want to be writing code if we don't have to. If there's a PaaS service out there, we should be using it. That's basically what we've always been talking about. And if we have to write to this library, we're going to be, restricted to writing what it offers, and we're not going to be able to take advantage of all these other services because they may not be able available on all the cloud vendors, right? Like something like DocumentDB, I mean, okay, there may be different implementations on different cloud vendors. Some have MongoDB and whatnot, but if you take it a step further, media services. I don't know how mature that is on other cloud vendors. Things like that, we start looking into some of the features like App Insights or all the various features that we have. They're just not available on others. So what do? You have to start writing all that yourself now, right? Just because you want to have this very abstracted view of the cloud, and it's going to mean a lot more custom code for you, in my mind.
And the other thing that we've done, at least I've done in the past, when we were confronted with this about like, well, we don't want to have, kind of lock in here, is I would always, even though we didn't have something like this, we would build a little interface, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a big drawn out thing, but the interface itself would kind of abstract away from the cloud to say, well, what's the alternative? Take storage, for instance. We have blob storage, and customer says, I don't want to be locked to blob storage, so I need to be able to basically pull this back on-prem. So if I was going to pull it back on-prem and I'm using your object store, how do I do that? Because I can't run your blob service locally. And the answer, that I've given was like, well, we could build an interface over there, and then the interface will have the cloud, and it would have file system. And that way, I'm the one controlling it. So I know what features are in that cloud vendor, and I know what features are on that file system I'm writing to. So I can kind of massage it the way I want to do. Something like this libcloud's a little bit more generic, but certainly there's ways to kind of take advantage of those things like you're saying, Sajid, PaaS services and these things, but still provide a little bit of assurance that we could also be a little bit portable.
Very right. Very well put, Kale.
Yeah.
Now, what's this comment you put in there about IO patterns? So what have you seen in that area?
Yeah, you know, the thing here that always strikes me is especially around, you know, things that are very IO intensive. I don't know SQL Server so much, but maybe NoSQL databases and these kind of things. There's definitely different patterns, and I think the thing to call out here, at least from my experience, is if you're on different cloud vendors, or even on-prem going up to Azure, or any other cloud vendor, is understanding how it works. I harp on storage all the time because storage is like fundamental to everything, and it's like understanding how that thing actually functions from a performance standpoint. What are all your options? Understanding all those pieces when you're moving things around, it has a huge impact. Could have a huge impact on the performance of your application, especially when you get in these big distributed databases and those types of things. So, I just wanted to call it out as like, you know, we talk about lift and shift all the time and these kind of things, and it sounds great, and sometimes it can work, but you know, it's also important to understand what's going on kind of under the covers.
Very right, indeed. And then taking that a step further, just you mentioned about VM sizes, right? I guess, do you mean over there that different cloud vendors have different capacities for VMs? Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, I think this, and maybe Evan can comment on this one some too. The I think he's as close to him, but the different, you know, SKUs, I guess they would call them. If you look at any cloud vendor, they have different performance levels, and some are optimized for compute, and some are I/O, and some are general, and so there's all these different mix. We seem to have a ton of them now, but it's great because the more we have, the more granular they are, so you can pick the exact feature set that you want. But it also is something to consider if you're moving, especially if you're moving between cloud vendors, or you're trying to do something where you're in both of them, is that's an exercise, you know, to sit down and try to say, okay, so it's this on this one, so how does that work on this one? You know, how do they kind of map up, you know?
I mean, when you ask for benchmarks, we don't offer benchmarks, right, for each of our VMs.
We recommend the types of workloads that go with some of them. But I'll be honest, my experience has been kind of even before that, very few customers actually know what their IO pattern is. Right?
That's true.
Unless there's somebody that really is obsesses about storage, and even then, it's like, well, I think my IO pattern is this. Well,
and that may be the case, Evan, but. If they have an app running, let's say in AWS today, and some, I forget what their VMs are called, SKUs are called, but
EC2,
yeah. You know, but like, you know, what is their granular names for their VM types and whatnot? Like, if they're using one particular type of size of VM in AWS, and they want to move that to Azure, like, how do they find the comparable, you know, SKU in Azure that matches that, right? Because they know their app runs well on that particular VM in AWS. They'd want something similar in Azure, right?
Oh, you're talking like how much RAM, how many CPUs, and what storage you've got with it.
And the I/O and everything, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just taking all those parameters together and mapping them between different cloud vendor VM options.
I think in some ways what we're hitting on is, and this probably isn't a huge problem today, but I think it's going to be the reality as we go forward. I mean, if you look at on-premises, you know, when's the last time somebody has really picked up their application and moved it from physical server A to physical server B, and it was seamless, right? Because even the same hardware is not really the same hardware, right? I mean, you think it is, but there's some subtle differences. I think that's what we're going to see as we see this cloud stuff is, you know, for whatever good reason, you move from cloud vendor A to cloud vendor B. Now you got to go, okay, how do I match my performance? How do I match my you know, resources? How do I match my OPAT? How do I do all that stuff as I look at these different ones?
And, you know, Evan, you want to hear about something even kind of funnier. Well, it may not be that funny if you're facing this kind of problem. But you know, a lot of customers I work with, they have these old applications, right? They're running on these old boxes, and they're kind of, you know, reluctant to move them onto new hardware. And finally, you know, they have to because the support is gone from that vendor, and they have to move the apps over to a new box, which is a lot faster, right? Because it's newer technology.
Yep.
and the app breaks. Why? Because a lot of the bugs become more obvious when it's running on faster processors, right? There's locking problems that become obvious. On a slow processor, they were all hidden. They probably never showed up. So that's another problem that you have to face. If you're moving to the cloud, same thing. The cloud is assumed to be all modern hardware, right? We don't have any legacy hardware. And you move your app up there, and so all of a sudden, it's like, hey, wait a minute, what's all these? Why is it crashing?
Yeah, it reminds me of the days when I first started doing support was when we were moving from single core machines to dual core. And man, we found threading issues left and right all the time. And it was always, hey, I got this brand new box. Oh, it's multi-core. Oh, crap. But I think you're right. I mean, you're going to see things like, hey, I moved to a faster machine that happens to have more CPUs but lower clock speed.
There you go.
Right? Depending on your workload, that could be a huge difference.
Exactly.
Right. So no, you're absolutely right. It's I have seen many a customer that has said, well, I installed it on this box 10 years ago and I haven't touched it since in the hopes that it doesn't ever break. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, no, so you had put a couple things there to
Yeah,
also a
just
couple links.
yeah, kind of in the same. I guess there are other cloud frameworks that are out there. We often talk about EC2, the Amazon and the Azure, and maybe the Google APIs, but they have OpenStack.org, which is, I think, fairly popular, right, Kale? That's fairly well known.
Yeah, you
And
see it around a lot.
yeah, the funny thing about that, I feel like I'm in Inception, because you could run OpenStack in Azure. So you're like, wait a second, I'm running like virtualized storage on top of virtualized storage. What happened here?
Well, now wait a minute. As of what? Now you can. Is it? I guess it's released. Is it 20 server 2016?
Yep.
You can virtualize with it. You can do virtualization within a virtualized VM.
Right. Yes.
I'm not. Again, I'm not quite sure why you would want to do that, but you can. So there's going to be somebody that's going to find a good reason for it.
So everybody just go buy G series, and then you only need two of them. You're good.
There you go.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. So we can do containers on a virtualized VM running on
Oh
top
my
of
gosh.
a.
That's the third level. Isn't that in Inception? When you get lost, you're in the third level.
Yeah, exactly.
So they have, so OpenStack, has this where they virtualize a compute, networking, and storage, right? That's the most common thing that people do. And if you build your app on that, then you could technically run it anywhere, right? Azure included, obviously, and I'm sure AWS has one. So you could run your app anywhere if you wrote to their API. So that's one of the popular ones out there. The other one that I found in my research was CloudScale. And CloudScale is more focused on trying to come up with ways to make apps scale better. Okay, so it kind of attacks the problem of scalability more than anything else. But again, it does it in a way that is kind of portable, and you could, if you write to it, you could run it on different cloud vendors. And then there's a third one, which is the HP Helion Eucalyptus project. And this one's a little more limited in its scope. It's more storage oriented, probably more like what's the one that you mentioned, Kale, earlier? The libcloud, right? Was that storage or? Yeah. So it's kind of more on that end. So there's other options out there for writing apps that could run on all available cloud vendors. I just, I don't know. I don't think that's the right approach. I don't know why. I think is it some sort of like a management thing, like where it, people like the CIO feels good to know that they can move their entire environment from AWS to Amazon, I mean to Azure or vice versa, and not be locked into a vendor. Is that the goal, the end goal? And does that make a big difference to people?
I mean, there is a class of customers and people that are, kind of have a certain perception that is absolutely their driving factor, right? They don't want to be locked in. They want to use open source. They want to, implement this. Now, and again, I'm fairly neutral to it because again, I'm in support. I will support you whatever you're doing, but you know, you do have to wonder sometimes, is that because that's a philosophy or there's actually a business benefit?
Right. That's what I'm trying to...
I think there's a mix of both. Some people are doing it because they have this, you know, I will only do open source or, you know, or whatever. And other people, actually, there's, you know, some feature or functionality that, that drives them to that.
Right. I mean, I often wonder, like, does AWS and Azure, do they, can you negotiate with them? Like, oh, you know, I'm going to move my workload there unless you, I don't know, give me half the rate. Does that happen?
I am absolutely sure it does. And I swear I've never been on calls where customers have threatened to leave, ever. No, never.
Now, I see it, you know, the... I've heard that comment before, before from customers saying that they wanted to be agnostic, but I've also seen a lot more of the migration stuff. And for me, that's, I think that's where some of these tools, I see the future, the benefit for these tools is, you know, if we're moving something from on-prem up there, how can we kind of enable that easier? Maybe it works between cloud vendors, but, you know, I'm not sure that's reality for a lot of people. But yeah.
On-prem to cloud is a good way to look at this. Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that Azure Stack, I don't know for sure if that's why the word stack is in it, but I'm sure there is some element of, you know, OpenStack is pushing Azure Stack, right? You know, hey, I can do this.
Yeah,
I can do OpenStack on-prem. I can do OpenStack in Azure or in, well, on Azure, on AWS, whatever, on Rackspace. You know, Azure, that's driving Azure to do things as well.
Good point. Yep. All right. So I think that was a good topic, Kale. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, no. Great suggestion, Kale.
Yeah, no, it's good.
And
thank you,
and our listeners, if you have any thoughts on this particular, it's a more of a discussion forum today, but if you have any thoughts on this, either way, please drop us a line on our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast and let us know, and we'll discuss it on a future episode of the podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
So we'll put all these links in the show notes, and hopefully our listeners will get something out of it. Well, guys, good chatting up on this topic, and hope you all have a good evening.
Thanks, good. Bye, guys.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.